Dialectical Behavior Therapy was created in the 1980s by Marsha Linehan in Seattle, Washington.
Today, DBT is taught all over the world.
We're two therapists who believe everyone can benefit from DBT skills.
I'm Kate.
I'm Michelle.
And this is DBT and Me.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, everybody.
It's a special episode, boys and girls and everyone else. We're going to talk about the book today,
yes.
Which is weird. I don't know. We'll wait and see how long it takes before it gets comfortable. I still carry it around with me like a teddy bear a little bit, like it's going to stop being real if I let it too far away from my physical body. And at the same time, I'm a little horrified every time I mention it to people because it feels like bragging. And I want to brag about it. A lot of dialectics in this one. But before we get into talking about life in general and also the book, reading some portions thereof, etc., I do want to say thank you to our new patron, Daniel. Big shout out. Thank you so much, Daniel, for supporting us and the podcast. And I can't think of anything else to say in introduction other than how's life, Michelle?
I know. Yeah. I mean, all the promotion stuff is now in the show notes, so we make it way easier for ourselves.
Oh, my God. No, you're just calling me out. I haven't done an introduction in months. That's perfect. I just forgot everything. Well, I can't think of anything. All right, guys. I'm really nervous about a speech I'm giving tonight, and I don't think I have a brain. Anyway, in case I flub up more for the rest of it. All right, hold on. What's the rest of it? So you can write to us emails at dbtandmepodcast@gmail.com. You can check us out on Facebook, dbtandmepodcast/Facebook/group, I think.
Oh, it's
we don't normally read that one out.
Just search for DBT and me. You'll find us.
That's true. It's not like the couch and the chair, which just gives you furniture, sadly. Things I didn't think to check before naming the other podcast. Anyway, and what else? Oh, patron. So, like Daniel, if you would also like to get shouted out by Michelle, who will do it better next month, go ahead and join us at Patreon, DBT and Me podcast. Search there as well. Did I get it all this time?
I believe so. And again, if you missed anything, just check the show notes. That's right. There's Etsy. There's other cool things.
Oh my God. I'm very human today, folks. That's all I'm saying.
But the main thing we're promoting today above all is the book. So it doesn't really matter what else there is. We're just talking about the book today.
Gracious me. Well, you talk about life. I'll gather my brain and see if I can find five cells to rub together before you're done.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, we thought it would be nice today to maybe just kick off with giving you all a little update on how each of us are doing, because we didn't record a monthly episode for the month of October because life was super chaotic. And I posted a little blurb just mentioning that we would be doing this month's podcast about the book and ways that you could be entered to win a free copy, which we are going to draw. Well, not draw. I drew the names earlier. We already know the winners. We're going to announce the winners at the
end.
But I mentioned in that little 10-minute clip or whatever it was about how, you know, Kate had had a surgery and I was moving. And so we wanted to just update you all on those things briefly before we dive into talking about the book. So on my end, yeah, life has been real chaotic over the last, I guess, 6 to 8 weeks or so. My husband and I decided we wanted to, it's been something we've talked about for a long time and kind of tried to do in the spring and it just didn't work out, but we decided that now is the time to try to look at moving into a bigger home for our family, which is an exciting transition and a very stressful one. I have never bought a house before, let alone sold a house that I am currently living in. My husband bought the house we both live in on his own before we were dating. So this is all a brand new process for me. But basically, the update is a mixed bag, I suppose. The good news is that we found a house about a month ago that we really, really liked, and we decided to put in an offer, and the offer was accepted, which is very exciting. The more challenging news is that we're doing what's called a contingent offer. If you have no idea what that is, what it means is that because we are buying and selling at the same time, the only way that we are able to move into our new home is to sell our current home within 45 days. The reason for this is so that we don't wind up having any period of time where we're having to live in a hotel or anything crazy like that. But our house has been on the market for about 3.5 weeks now and counting, and our house has not yet sold. So we're in this weird period of time. Well, hopefully, I just realized this. Hopefully it will have sold by the time this episode is released. Oh. This episode is released on the 29th. We're recording it on the 13th. So I really sincerely hope that actually by the time this episode posts, our house will have sold and we will have gotten an offer on our house. But moving is just pretty chaotic. It's a big roller coaster of trying to pack up a lot of things and going to open houses and getting out of your house for showings if people want to come look at it. It's just been a lot of that stuff going on. And that was a big reason why we were like, no, not up for recording last month, because there was just something new every day, it seemed like. But that's my life update, is that I have a potential new house, but I've not been able to move into it yet. So I'm hoping soon.
Fingers crossed that the deal is sealed by the time of this releases.
All right, so...
Me. Well, I guess I'll start with the obvious, which is my brain is borked today, guys, which is thematic of late. So I, as Michelle mentioned, had surgery on the 25th of September. I had breast reduction surgery, which, to skip to the conclusion, best thing ever. So incredibly grateful. It's the first time in like 20 years-ish that every breath I take doesn't hurt. So that's pretty exciting. Sorry. Excuse me. Gracious me. It's a remarkable goodness. Everything about the end result is happy making to me in that regard. That said, despite being warned by people who knew better than me, I had bad expectations for what the healing process was going to look like. And so the doctor was like, you might want to take 2 or 3 weeks. You want to take 2, maybe 3 weeks off of work. I was like, well, that's okay. You know, I sit for a living, right? Just sit still. That's it. And he goes, yep. You'll want to take 2 weeks off, maybe a third, maybe at least a light entrance into work on the third week. And I'm like, sure. So I took 2 weeks off and I thought I was being indulgent. I was like, look at how good I am. I'm taking 2 whole weeks off, even when it's hard to afford and stressful in all these other ways. I'm sure I'll have a sucky first week and then the second week will feel like vacation. Then I'll be ready to jump back into work with both feet for the third week. I was very wrong. And I ought to have listened to the doctor. And also my therapist, in case we're just calling me out on things. Because she also told me it would be a lot harder than I was making it out to be. Ha ha ha. Anyway, in case you wondered if we don't listen to ourselves. We don't always listen to ourselves. But, so it's just been, it was very hard. I did return to work on week 3, with no reduction. It was not a light week. It was a normal week. And that was an horrific mistake. By the end of the week, just getting up off the couch to get up and ready for work, I just burst into tears crying because my body was so fucking done. I wasn't sad. I wasn't crying from sadness or even anxiety, just from my body being donezo. So huge amounts of swelling and there was pain and it was so much harder than I thought. I was like, I've had organs removed. This won't be that much worse. It's so much worse. Which is why I wanted to preface it with saying so worth it, because I have a lot of complaining to do about the healing process. But that said, it could be 10 times worse than it was and it would still be worth it. So incredibly grateful. But yeah, that ate my brain and my life. I basically was only sitting upright for work for at least the first 3 weeks. Probably into the 4th and 5th week, because I got the flu on the 4th week, because, of course. But yeah, now I'm much better. We're still not at 100%. I've got itching and stuff from healing processes and things like that, but I can dress normally and move more or less normally. I don't have any active restrictions on what I can pick up. I can go back to doing, because I was doing a whole lot of aerobics before that. Nope. But I can go back to things like roller skating and other aerobic activities, and recovery is more or less complete. But There were probably 5 solid weeks there where it was really probably the biggest influence on my world, and I just did not have any space for sitting up for anything that wasn't a client, which is part of why we did not do this last month, is because when we would have had to do it, the idea of sitting up for another 2-hour stretch would have made me cry a lot. So that's me. Nice. Better now, but life's been hard.
Yeah. For what it's worth, I have been very impressed by how, I don't know, I know obviously we're just now sharing with our listeners how we've been doing over the last month, but in general, right, like your personal updates on your Facebook and stuff, and just being really transparent about like the challenges of this journey post-surgery, but also just how it's felt for you emotionally. And yeah, it's been really cool to bear witness to that.
It helped me a lot to find recountings by other women online who had gotten the surgery. And so I don't have a blog or other things like that. So the closest I have is my Facebook, but I wanted to be a resource if I could be for other people, because there was just people I found were bloggers. My weird little aside of sadness is I thought I'd found people who were giving me really good stories, and then I realized that they were professional vloggers who happened to get the surgery. And so it was still not the kind of like raw kind of recounting of things that I thought I was getting. Yeah. So I was like, all right, I just need to put it out there as very blatant. Yeah. The ups and downs and sidewayses of this. Like not getting to be able to be hugged really for weeks was so much harder than I thought. Anyway. So hard, but if anybody's out there considering to doing it, I'll say the same thing to you that every person I talked to before that had gotten the surgery said to me, which was the best thing they'd ever done in their life. Do it sooner rather than later. So there, that's my, yeah. I'm just sad I didn't do it 20 years earlier. That's my only regret. Yeah. So, tell us about the book, Michelle.
Okay.
I'm sure I don't know anything about it.
So we thought it would be a good place to start by giving an overview of the book. When Kate and I very first announced on the podcast, what did we record? I think it was a very short episode, like 20 minutes or something a few months ago when we were announcing the book. So some of the stuff we talked about then, but we're just going to give a recap before we dive into actually reading portions of the book itself as a sneak peek for all of you. We're just going to give an overview of what you can expect from the book, how it's laid out, and how it may be helpful for you. So, the title of the book is a long title. I just call it DBT for everyone, because that's just short and quick and easy. But the full title of the book is DBT for Everyone, A Guide to the Perks, Pitfalls, and Possibilities of DBT for Better Mental Health. For the record, we did not come up with this title. The publishing company did, because we had a working title, but it wasn't very good and we weren't really sure about it. And we were like, you have a whole marketing team. We trust you all to come up with a better title than we did. And
Then they did come up with titles, and then we were like, oh God, those are terrible. What about these? And they seemed to think every single thing we thought was good was too short. And so this was the compromise that was reached at the end.
This was the middle ground.
About the alliteration.
Yep. Yeah. They came up with it. We were like, okay, that will do. But ultimately, as it says, right, a guide to the perks, pitfalls, and possibilities of DBT for better mental health. So obviously it's a book about DBT skills. So each chapter is about a different DBT skill. We did not cover every single DBT skill, but we got most of them. The vast majority of DBT skills are in this book. So in each chapter, we give an overview, an explanation in our own words of what the skill is. If it is an acronym skill, we dive into talking about what each of the letters stands for. So after we give an overview of the skill, then we each talked about our tips for the skill. And really, our tip sections, I feel like, are kind of just it's free form, like our thoughts, right? What do we think about this skill? How do we use this skill personally? What do we find helpful about it? How do we talk about it with our clients? So you really get to hear in each of those sections, like Kate's unique take and my unique take on each skill. And then we get into, as the title says, we get into pitfalls of the skill, because this is something that we're really passionate about that we hope comes through on the podcast, which is that we think DBT skills are amazing. And we also know that they're not easy to use. And that a lot of times people will learn about a DBT skill, they will try it, and they will then come back and go, it didn't work for me. For one reason or another. We hear this in groups. We hear this from people who write in to us with Q&A questions, right? I'm trying to use the skill. I'm struggling with the skill. It's not working. What am I doing wrong? So the pitfall sections, which Kate wrote all of the pitfall sections in each chapter, that really, we narrowed it down, I think, to the three pitfalls for each skill. Mm-hmm. So we boiled down all that feedback that we've heard over the years about what people find challenging about a certain skill. And we talk about the pitfalls of it. So things that we want to make sure that you are aware of when you're trying out this skill so that you can avoid some of the things that other people often wind up inadvertently falling into and finding to be a challenge with the skill. We're going to basically give you a warning about these could be three big pitfalls with this skill, and this is how you can avoid them. So we have that section, and then we have a benefits section for each skill, which I wrote of the main three benefits, which let me tell you, was because I wrote that those parts, the benefits parts of each chapter, and it was tough sometimes to really take and boil down, you know, what makes this skill good? Why use this skill? What do you get out of it? And I think Kate gave me the feedback sometimes when we were proofreading and editing, which was a freaking long process, of Kate's just like, you're talking about like three different benefits within this one benefit. Like, what are you really trying to say? And I'm like, I don't know. Cause it's all stuff that's good about the skill. I don't know. But we try to boil it down into the three biggest reasons. If we had to pitch each skill to you, why should you use this skill? What will you get out of it? The three biggest benefits that you can expect. And then each chapter ends with three different journaling questions. And there's a page where there's actually lines. And if you like to write in books and take notes in books, you can absolutely fill in the blanks with your answers. And this was important to us because DBT skills look different for everybody. The way that Kate might look using a certain skill might be different than how it looks for me using a certain skill. And so we wanted to give the readers an opportunity to reflect on the chapter once they finish reading it and think about how could this actually look for me? What do I think I could find helpful about this skill, or what might be challenging for me about this skill, or that kind of a thing. So basically, to boil it down, each chapter gives an overview of what the skill is. We each talk about some tips that we have for the skill. We talk about the pitfalls, the benefits, and then we have some journaling questions. We do that for nearly every DBT skill that there is. As far as if you are wondering, is this book for me, right? Who is this book geared towards? Because that was a big question we had to answer over and over and over again for the publishing company, right? Who are we writing to? Are we writing to people who are brand new to DBT and have never heard of it before? Are we writing to people who already know quite a bit about DBT? Are we writing to fellow therapists and professionals? And every time I think Kate and I kind of got stumped with this question because we were like, yes.
Yes.
It says DBT for everyone. We want to speak to all of those people, which it's very hard to write a book that everybody is going to find helpful. But I did just want to speak real briefly to, regardless of what boat you're in, whether it's somebody who is brand new to DBT, somebody who does have a lot of DBT experience, or a mental health professional, at least my take on why I think the book could be beneficial for each of those, I guess, I was about to say three categories, each of those three groups of people, right? So for somebody who is brand new to DBT, they don't know any DBT skills. They don't know what DBT stands for. They know nothing. They know nothing about what to expect. What I like about the book, and this is how we try to communicate in the podcast too, we try to make DBT very easy to understand. We try to use terms that are not too clinical sounding. We try to make the material really accessible so that if you are reading and learning about this for the first time, you're going to be able to hopefully get to the end of the overview section of each chapter and say, huh, I get it. That makes sense. That's our goal, is to not have it be a super complicated book, but one where the chapters are pretty easily digestible, not too long, and where when you're just first reading about a skill, you're hopefully going to be able to feel like you have a good understanding of what we're talking about. So it's a really easy to understand book, I think. That was our goal and our hope anyways. For those of you who are experienced with DBT, I think the way that this book will most benefit you is maybe less the overview section. I mean, of course, read that if you're curious and want a refresher on what each skill is and that kind of a thing. But I think what's really going to speak to you, if you've been using DBT for a long time and you feel like you understand what the skills are pretty well, would be our tip sections and maybe the pitfall sections. I think the pitfall sections of each chapter, again, are really important because it speaks to, if you've been trying out this skill and you've struggled with it, here are some reasons why you may be having a hard time, and here are some things you can do differently. And I think that's missing from a lot of other DBT books out there. They're really good at explaining, here are the skills, but I don't think they're so good about naming, oh, and then this part of the skill is tough. Or if you were trying to use this skill in this certain context, it's not going to work for you. So don't use it in that context. Save yourself the trouble. We don't feel like a lot of other books out there talk about DBT in that way. So those are the sections that I think are really helpful for the more experienced folks out there with a lot of DBT knowledge, would be our tip sections and then the pitfall sections. And if you're a professional, a mental health professional, I think the biggest section that's gonna help you is the benefits section. Because when you are talking about skills with your clients, and when your clients are basically going, okay, but how is this actually going to help me? Why should I really do this? I think what we talk about in the benefits section may really help in terms of narrowing it down to how this skill could really be useful in your client's life. The pitfall section may also be pretty helpful for you in each chapter. Because again, if you have a client who's coming to you saying that they're trying these skills and it's not working, it may give you, I guess, a head start, we could say, as to why potentially that may be that they're struggling with the skill, and then some directions you could point them in for how to have more success with it. So I truly do. I believe in my heart of hearts there's something for everybody in the book. And I feel so biased saying that because, of course, we wrote it. But I really feel proud of what we've done. And I do think that it could be helpful for a wide range of folks out there.
Awesome. I agree.
Good. I'm glad you agree.
Perhaps, obviously, I suppose, since I also fought for the title with you. So I'm going to start off by just giving you guys a taste of the introduction. So Michelle and I each have our own individual introductory chapters as well in the book. But this is the general introduction to the book. While our personal histories with DBT started within the past two decades, DBT itself is much older. DBT was developed in the 1970s at the University of Washington in Seattle by Dr. Marcia Linehan, a clinical psychologist. She created DBT originally to treat borderline personality disorder, a disorder at the time that was considered untreatable by many in the psychology community. Since its creation, innumerable research studies have been done on DBT, and it has been found to be effective in a wide array of issues beyond BPD. DBT programs were structured around four modules with accompanying worksheets to complete. We formatted our book similarly into four parts corresponding with each of the four DBT modules. The most common worksheets used, and the ones we reference in this book, were created by Linehan herself. Besides very different personal introductions to DBT, as we mentioned in our prefaces, there are a lot of ways in which we differ from each other. Kate walks barefoot everywhere, including in public. Michelle wasn't allowed outside without shoes as a child, and so is rarely ever barefoot. Kate dyes her hair myriad colors. Michelle has never dyed her hair. While Michelle is organized and scheduled, Kate is more scattered and impulsive. The list could go on. When we first met in community mental health, we didn't think we would ever become close friends, let alone go on to start two podcasts together and write this book. We've come to see over the years that our differences actually make us a perfect fit as colleagues and friends. DBT is all about dialectics, and the dialectic for the two of us is that we are very different and also very similar in meaningful ways. We both are quite talkative while also being attentive listeners. No surprise we became therapists. We experienced challenging relationships and found understanding in each other. We hold very similar values. When we were approached to write this book, we thought, why us? After all, there are DBT books already on the market. What could we add to the mix? But the answer came to us almost immediately. We have our different personalities and experiences to share. Neither of us thought when we launched our podcast, DBT and Me, that it would grow as much as it has. People benefit from learning the skills, sure, but what we hear repeatedly is how much people benefit from our personal sharing and our dynamic together as we talk about DBT. We have fun while we do it. We laugh while we do it. And for us, it hardly ever feels like work. A big thing we have in common is that we genuinely enjoy teaching these skills to other people and using them ourselves. That's what we hope to bring to this book. There are a number of different ways you may want to approach the material presented here. If this is your first exposure to the skills, we highly recommend that you read the book through, start to finish, in the order presented. That said, if you know you really need distress tolerance skills, or perhaps your therapist has suggested you look into a particular set of skills, you can skip around in the book, reading it in the order that feels most relevant to you. After you've read through all the skills, or if you're coming to this book for more of a refresher after already going through a DBT course, you can use the index to look up a skill you're struggling with or to find a skill you're wanting to utilize. Ultimately, approach it as feels best and works best for you. In each chapter, you'll hear both of our unique perspectives. After you read about what the skill is, you'll see tips from us both. We will then talk about potential pitfalls of the skill and potential benefits of using it. We end each chapter with questions for you to answer about how you will see that skill fitting into your life. Above all, we want you to actually integrate what you're reading by going out and using these skills. We both believe wholeheartedly that DBT is not perfect, and it can be extremely helpful and life-changing. We think DBT is here for everyone, no matter how big or small your life challenges are. We are grateful for you joining us, and we are honored to be a part of your mental health journey.
Ta-da!
I was about to say ta-da. We almost really? Jinxed.
Yes.
It's been a while since we read it.
It has been a while since we read it. That's what's so crazy is that you take the time to write it out, then you read it and reread it and reread it and edit it and edit it and edit it. But yeah, we haven't looked at it in quite some time. Yeah, so it's interesting. So we wanted to today, Kate and I each chose a part of the book to read. I chose the willingness versus willfulness chapter, and Kate chose the tip sections, both of our tips from ABC. And so we're now going to read those parts of the book aloud for you. So it gives you a good taste of what you're in for with the book itself and what you can expect. But as for why we realized that our reasons for why we each picked the section that we picked were pretty similar. We both picked skills that are personally pretty meaningful to us. For me, I think willingness is I don't talk about it enough, but I think willingness is a hugely important DBT skill. And one that I have struggled with throughout my life. So it's one that I feel a lot of passion for. And you said you feel pretty much the same about ABC, that you think ABC is like a very important skill. And we also really felt that each of these sections of the book really speak to and highlight our differences and how we balance and complement each other with the different ways that we approached our tip sections and talking about these skills. And I think just overall, I don't know, I feel pretty proud of how we explain and talk about the skills. I mean, I was the one who wrote the overview section of each skill, which for some skills was harder than others and took more time than others. But especially like with the willingness versus willfulness chapter, writing that overview, I feel pretty proud of it. That's why we chose these two parts. So we're going to start with reading the willingness versus willfulness chapter, and then we'll read the tips from the ABC chapter. Okay, I will kick it off. So it says, about this skill. Most days, you probably experience events you dislike. There's too much traffic on your commute. Your partner didn't do the dishes. Again. You wanted to go for a walk, but now it's raining. Life does not always go according to plan. In fact, it rarely does. When things are not going as you hope, you have two options before you: to be willful or to be willing. According to Linehan, willfulness is insisting on being in control and refusing to make changes that are needed. More or less, willfulness is stubbornly digging in your heels about what you want or what you believe to be right. When you're in a willful state of mind, your focus tends to be only on your own needs and desires. It can be difficult to zoom out and consider the big picture of what's going on around you, your long-term goals, or what may be a more effective choice. You want what you want, and you will try to get it at all costs, even if there's plenty of evidence telling you to change course and do something different. Willfulness is rigidity. On the other hand, there is a choice to be willing. Willingness is doing just what is needed in each situation wholeheartedly without dragging your feet. That's a direct quote from Linehan. When you are willing, you are open to the possibilities around you without clinging to the outcome you are hoping for. You are able to easily adapt and adjust in the moment. To sum it up in a word, willingness is synonymous with flexibility. In order to practice willingness, it's important to turn to the foundational skills of wise mind and mindfulness. Willingness requires you to be present. It's going to be difficult to act with awareness if your attention is elsewhere. Mindfulness brings you into the present moment, and wise mind helps guide you to consider all sides of a situation. Without making decisions based purely on emotion or logic alone, wise mind helps you consider both your emotional desires and the reality of what's before you to determine your next steps. Let's break down the situations listed above to show the difference between a willful and willing approach. If there's traffic during a commute, a willful approach would be: complain about the traffic, honk your horn, be critical of yourself for not leaving the house on time, or finding fault in others for causing the traffic. A willing approach would be to turn on the music and sing along, look at the scenery around you while you sit in traffic, appreciate when people allow you to merge over, or tell yourself, "I'll get there when I get there." If your partner didn't do the dishes, a willful approach would be to do them yourself without saying a word, making a lot of noise in the kitchen, be sullen and distant from your partner the rest of the night to show them you're unhappy, refuse to take out the trash or do other tasks around the house in retaliation, let the dishes build up for days until your partner finally does them. A willing approach would be to do them yourself without resentment, or directly ask your partner to do them using "Dear Man." If it's raining when you wanted to go for a walk, a willful approach would be to tell yourself there's no point in going for a walk and sulk. Refuse to find another alternative for how to fill your time, or complain about the weather to others. A willing approach would be to put on a jacket and go for the walk anyways. Find an indoor activity you enjoy doing. Tell yourself you can go for a walk another day, and it's okay to do something else today. Cultivating willingness takes intentional practice, especially if you have current or past people in your life, like your parents, who are often willful when faced with unexpected challenges. In the tips sections, we will walk you through our own examples of willfulness and how we practice willingness ourselves.
All right. Kate's tips. This is a skill I love to hate and hate to love. I think it's great and useful when I'm in a willing state already, but I think it's awful and don't want to do it when I'm in a willful state, which demonstrates willfulness perfectly, right? When I'm in a willful state, for me, it absolutely presents like being a sullen teenager with a dose of toddler thrown in for good measure. Whether literal or metaphorical, it can go either way, involves a lot of arms crossed over my chest, eye rolling, and saying or thinking, "whatever," and "I don't wanna." It's not a comfortable place to be emotionally, and it certainly makes me unpleasant to be around. For me, willfulness shows up around emotional states. I'm prone to clinging to my unhappiness. Maybe I don't want to move on because I think the person who upset me needs to really see just how much they upset me, or because I want them to feel bad, or not get what they want from me or the situation. Maybe I cling because I think if I get over something too quickly, it invalidates the emotions I'm feeling. When I get unhappy, especially if I'm unhappy because of something someone else did, I'm prone to actively trying to stay in that state. I become inflexible and rigid in my emotional state, rather than allowing my emotions to change without clinging. So, how do I get into a willing state from here? Tip 1. Notice. Like with so many other things, the first step is noticing where I am in the first place. It can be a struggle for me to notice when I'm in a willful state. What helps me is really understanding what willfulness looks like for me, and what situations it most commonly shows up in. I recommend, when not in a willful state, sitting down and thinking about times you've been willful. Try to see what those times have in common. Try to remember what it felt like in your body, what kind of things you were thinking, or if the stimuli that tipped you into a willful place were similar in each one. The more you build your awareness of how and when willfulness shows up for you, the faster you'll notice it when you end up in a willful space in the future. Tip 2. Realize I'm mostly hurting myself. Once I've noticed I'm in a willful place in my head, the next step for me on the path to willingness is realizing that I'm mostly hurting myself. It's very unlikely that clinging to my bad mood is actually communicating effectively with whoever upset me. Turns out talking works a lot better. Staying in the bad mood doesn't actually have any bearing on the validity or reality of the emotions I'm having. Staying in a bad mood only means I'm suffering more and for longer. Allowing myself to move on from my emotions will actually help me to communicate more clearly with those around me. Moving through the emotions is also healthier and less painful. Once I notice I'm being willful, mostly just causing myself more suffering and not achieving any of my other quote-unquote goals, I find it much easier to shift from a space of willfulness into a space of willingness. Try asking yourself what the actual impacts are of your willful actions. Tip 3. Distraction. One of the most effective tools I use for getting out of a willful headspace is to distract myself. It's best if it's with something that elicits a very different emotion from the one I'm mired in. This is using the E from accepts. I do an activity that is engrossing and evokes a new emotional state, like watching stand-up comedy or horror, reading a favorite book, or baking. I might also use opposite action, which might look like trying to pleasantly engage with the person who upset me. Once I've knocked loose the stuck emotion, I find it much easier to return to a place of being flexible in the moment and willing to go with the flow again.
Michelle's tips. I have struggled with willfulness for most of my life because I'm often busy with appointments, chores, emails, and more. I have a habit of trying to do too much with not enough time. I conceptualize this as being like Jenga. In the game of Jenga, you take wooden blocks and build a tower as tall as you can. One by one, you remove the blocks, hoping the tower stays standing for as long as possible. Most days of my life, I construct a plan. I decide what I want to get done and when I want to do it. Some days, everything works out perfectly. But those days are the exception, not the rule. Most days, something happens I don't expect. I get a phone call that needs my attention when I'm in the middle of something important. The lines at the grocery store take longer than expected, or a friend shows up late to the lunch we planned. All of a sudden, my picture-perfect plans aren't working anymore. Just like when you remove that one block from the Jenga tower and it collapses, so too would my schedule collapse around me with a ripple effect. If one thing didn't go according to plan, I would tell myself my day was ruined. I would get upset and blame other people for their incompetence. I would tell myself in frustration, why can't everything just go how it's supposed to? In other words, I cling tightly to control and how I think things should be. I'm not in the flow of life, and I struggle to let go so I can adapt and become more willing. Thank goodness for my therapist, who has helped me move towards willingness over the years. I have learned a few things from her that I will share with you. If you're a type A driven, perfectionistic person, listen up. You're who I'm talking to, because we are the people often most guilty of willfulness. This is how I've slowly shifted to a more willing stance. Tip 1. Allow wiggle room. We live in a fast-paced culture that is constantly moving. We're told the more we can do, the better. At a certain point, I told myself to stop scheduling so many things in a day because it was creating the dynamic I described of needing everything to go perfectly or else. I now try to limit myself to only one big thing a day, i.e. one get-together with a friend, one doctor's appointment, etc. This means I can be more in the moment when I'm there without watching the clock, hoping I'll have time to get to the next thing. It has greatly reduced my stress. Tip 2, take a deep breath. When things start to not go how you wish they would, close your eyes for just a moment and take a deep breath. It's more powerful and needed than you think. This is a beautiful time to tell yourself the world isn't going to end, you can figure out what to do next, and it's going to turn out just how it's meant to, even if that's different than how you originally saw it going. Tip 3, put it off until tomorrow. Most things do not need to get done right now. I understand the temptation to accomplish things as quickly as possible because I try to do that regularly. This leads to feelings of resentment, frustration, and shame over how long my to-do list is and questioning why I can't get it done in the time frame I set for myself. Thankfully, I've learned what to do. Make the to-do list shorter, accept what I can realistically do, and get to the rest another day. It's much better to accept your limitations than to push yourself and get upset when you can't do it all. Tip 4, accept help. Accepting help is a great way to practice willingness. We all have limitations and no one has all the answers. You can choose to keep trying it over and over on your own without success, or you can let someone else do it on the first try if it's more in their wheelhouse. It may not be perfect or how you would do it, but that's okay. You likely just saved yourself a lot of time while connecting with someone in your life who probably felt valued because you wanted their help. Tip 5, remind yourself you're human. It's okay to not be perfect. Willfulness tells you to push until something is as good as it can be. Willingness says it's okay to just do your best and know when to stop. When I'm in a willful state of mind, I become critical of myself and others. When I'm in a place of willingness, I'm more accepting and understanding of what I can and can't do. It takes a lot of pressure off to tell myself I'm human in moments of struggle.
Pitfalls. Pitfall 1. Like many skills, it's tempting to think that the switch from being willful to willing will happen instantaneously. Just realize you're being willful, decide to change to willing, and voila! No more willfulness. Sadly, it rarely works that way. While your mileage may vary, it can take several minutes to make the switch. Even after managing to move into a more willing headspace, you may sometimes need to make course corrections in order to stay there. It's easy to slip back into a willful state of mind. So when you try the skill, be ready for it to take a little while and to course correct as needed. Pro tip, noticing that you're slipping back into a willful state is easier to catch if you're already practicing mindfulness of emotions. Pitfall 2. When you're actively trying to shift your emotional and or mental state, you may be tempted to be hard on yourself for being willful in the first place. Try to remember that the willfulness came from somewhere. Maybe the situation reminds you of painful memories from your past, it's a response to being triggered, or it's because of a strained relationship. There are hundreds of reasons one might be willful. Even if these feelings don't fit the facts, and even if it makes sense to shift away from them, that doesn't mean it's a good idea to be hard on yourself for feeling this way. In fact, if you're a dick to yourself about it, it's going to be more difficult to shift. So, once you've noticed you're in a willful headspace, begin by validating where you are. Once you've done that, then it's time to work on being willing. Pitfall 3. Correctly labeling willfulness can be difficult. Most commonly, boundary setting is confused with willfulness. If other people perceive your boundary setting as willfulness, that can lead to questioning yourself. Is my boundary valid, or am I just being willful? Many people misinterpret boundaries as someone being unreasonable, stubborn, or petulant. This is where mindfulness and wise mind come in handy. If you're unsure whether you're actually being willful, take a few minutes to practice mindfulness of emotions or check in with your wise mind. It would feel terrible and certainly would not serve its intended purpose to try to override your own boundaries due to mislabeling them as willfulness. Don't discard your boundaries just because other people misunderstand them.
Benefits. Benefit 1. Willingness helps you stay open to new possibilities. When you are being willful, you are often convinced there is only one way. One right way to do something, one right outcome, one right opinion, etc. You then become single-mindedly focused on doing a task in only one manner, making sure you get the result you want, or arguing your points into the ground. There is no way to grow or change without first turning the mind towards willingness and being open to other possibilities. Taking a willing approach to life allows you to take in new information and consider other outcomes you may have first initially labeled as bad or wrong. When you are willing, you let go of your ego and need to be right. Instead, you access your wise mind and look freshly at options before you to decide what will be most effective. Being able to consider other outcomes is only possible with willingness. Benefit 2. Willingness connects you with others. Willingness helps you recognize your limitations. We all have strengths and we all have weaknesses. Willfulness wants you to believe you can do anything if you only try hard enough. While there can be value in persistence, there can also be a lot of hardship in not knowing when to stop and ask for help. Willingness helps you connect with others in two ways. First, you are more likely to seek help from others and allow their strengths to fill in where your weaknesses get you stuck. Second, a willing attitude helps you go along with what others may want to do instead of pushing for things to go your way without regard for what others are wanting. The narrow-minded nature of willfulness can really create division and misunderstanding in relationships. A willful person leaves those around them feeling left out and unheard. A willing person invites in other opinions, perspectives, and talents, focusing on what will benefit themselves and others simultaneously. Benefit 3. Willingness is the antidote to fear. Linehan says, "When willfulness is immovable, ask, what's the threat? Underneath willfulness is fear about what will happen if you are not in control. If things aren't going according to your plans, you tell yourself the only other alternative is that it falls apart. Letting go of control and trusting others and/or the universe is no easy task. Once you truly shift into willingness, you come to see there's not as much to fear as you once thought. The next time something unexpected or unwanted happens, do your best to welcome it, just as it is, even if you dislike it. Willingness helps you recognize there is not as much to fear when you are in the passenger seat of life as you might think."
Awesome. All right.
I was going to say, do we want to read the three questions at the end?
Oh, do we?
Oh, I guess we can, I suppose. Oh, and Kate wrote the questions for each chapter. The questions at the very end.
All right. So the questions for this one are... Thinking about willingness versus willfulness, can you think of a time you were willful? Give a brief description of what happened. Can you think of a time you were willing? Give a brief description of what happened then. In your current life circumstances, where do you see yourself being able to use this skill the most?
Nice. Okay. Switch on over to the ABC chapter and our tips.
Yeah, and our tips. All right, Kate's tips. Accumulate positive emotions. Accumulating positive emotions is one of my absolute favorites because I practice it frequently and the most instinctively. I have always been a person who notices the little things. I'll stand for 5 minutes watching a little bird flit about or watching the shifting colors of a sunset. I'll close my eyes and just savor an amazing bite of food. In short, I do my damnedest to mindfully attend to every small pleasure my world makes available. Even if only for a moment. Obviously, I still miss many of them. Despite that, I think this trait does more to sustain my mental well-being than possibly any other. When I teach the skill, I tell people to think of life as being a giant set of scales. On one side go all of your shitty experiences, and on the other side go all of your pleasant experiences. I then remind everyone that life will take care of making sure enough shitty things happen. You don't need to chase down suffering and sadness. They'll find you. You couldn't prevent them if you tried. That said, one thing you can do is make sure you're adding good things to the other side of the scale in order to help balance out the shitty. Maybe it could even tip the scales in your favor. Small things matter, and tiny pleasures count. If you've ever experienced severe depression, you know how hard it is to even consider trying to engage in grander pleasures. While grander, pleasant events such as a vacation will certainly add a lot to the weight of that side of the scale, you can add just as much weight there through a dozen smaller and probably more accessible things.
build mastery. We are all good at something. Yes, you included. Maybe you're good at something considered impressive by most people. Maybe you're good at something so unusual most people don't even know what it is. Maybe you're good at something utterly mundane, or even inane. I don't know what it is for you, but I know you're good at something. My favorite personal example is that I am incredibly good at making grilled cheese sandwiches. Are my grilled cheese sandwiches going to change the world? Certainly not. But it still feels good to make them for people because engaging in tasks where you feel competent feels really nice. And while doing things you already do well is great, definitely a mood and self-esteem booster, it may feel even better to be getting good at something. Picking up a new skill, practicing it, seeing your increasing ability, it's all just really, really helpful. My biggest tip here is to remember that your skill doesn't have to be amazing. You don't have to be the best at the skill. You don't have to have a skill anyone but you appreciates as such. Build mastery is for you, not anyone else. The only opinion or experience that matters here is yours. So go forth and make amazing grilled cheese sandwiches, or whatever your special skill is. I bet you notice an improvement in your mood and your self-worth when you do it. Cope ahead. The way I conceive of cope ahead is like using the power of your imagination for good instead of evil. I'm sure we're all quite used to using our imaginations for evil. I bet you have spent plenty of time imagining a dreaded upcoming event and imagining all the ways that dreaded event could go badly and all the ways you could fuck it up. The skill asks you to instead imagine that same dreaded event, but this time imagine yourself navigating the event skillfully and with even-keeled emotions. You can also think of this as rehearsing the event the same way race car drivers visualize themselves driving the track over and over in their heads as a way to practice. The more you imagine yourself doing a thing a particular way, the more likely you are to actually do the thing that way when the time comes. The good news here is that this means you are much more likely to behave skillfully if you just imagine yourself being skillful over and over again. The bad news is that you've probably already spent a lot of time imagining yourself acting unskillfully. You've already increased your chances of unskilled behavior, so try to be kind to yourself. Changing your habitual behavior is hard. Just return to imagining your own skillful behavior again and again. Over time, you will build up and reinforce new habits. Remember that your imagination is actually very powerful at shaping how you behave, and harness that power to your advantage.
Michelle's tips: accumulate positive emotions. I often talk to clients I work with about zooming out or zooming in on their lives when they are feeling stressed, worried, or depressed. Some people feel like their life, quote, looks good on paper, unquote. They have the dream existence with a career they love, a nice house, an overall happy marriage, and so on. However, they find themselves spending their time working constantly at their job or engaged in stressful activities during their free time. These people are drowning in their stress, and they're not taking the time to do short-term, pleasant events, even if they are living out their values through their work or other activities. I encourage them to zoom in on how they're spending their time and see where they can find even just 5 to 10 minutes to do something they enjoy. Other people may do well at enjoying themselves in their daily lives. They might spend their days with friends or have ample time to do small activities they like. But these folks feel empty and like their life doesn't hold any real meaning. They tend to feel like they don't have a direction or like something is missing that they want strongly. With these clients, I ask them to zoom out and think about their values and let those guide them with what big changes might need to be made in their lives. You absolutely need to accumulate positive emotions in both the short term and the long term to truly feel like you are leading a life worth living. For myself, I often neglect the short term. I get so caught up in trying to make sure the big picture of my life is what I want that I don't leave a lot of time or space to do something just for the enjoyment of it. It certainly is not easy to make time for pleasant events, and in order to do it consistently, I have to schedule it in. If I don't commit to doing it, I'll bypass it when the time comes in favor of doing something more productive. If you're like me, it's time to zoom in. Really look closely at how you're spending your days and decide if anything can be postponed or shifted to make space for more enjoyable little things. If you initially tell yourself nothing can change, look again. I guarantee that there's a way to make space in your life for at least one pleasant event today. Start with 10 minutes somewhere. You can also do the mundane tasks of life in a more enjoyable way. Sing along to music while you cook dinner or while you drive. Close your eyes and take a deep breath when you drink your morning coffee or tea and savor it. Watch a movie you like as you fold the laundry. Over time, those small things start to add up in a positive way. Before I move on to my build mastery section, I will mention that my child is getting a diaper change in the room next to me, so y'all might hear him playing around while I read. Build mastery. If you're a perfectionist like me, build mastery is both your friend and your enemy. On the one hand, if you're a perfectionist facing too many new tasks lately that you're stumbling through, you may need a reminder you're still good at something to help your bruised ego. On the other hand, a perfectionist focus tends to be on being the best. Doesn't matter if you get an A, you want an A+. If you're trying to build mastery and internally criticizing yourself throughout the activity you chose, it's a sign you need to pause. The goal of the skill is to feel good about yourself at the end of it, to feel proud of what you did. You also want to have an experience of feeling less stressed rather than more stressed because you didn't do that thing to your high standards. Ideally, building mastery helps you find a state of flow. For example, I love to do jigsaw puzzles, and I'm quite good at them. Sometimes I do puzzles that are really difficult and find myself having a headache after because I just spent 15 minutes trying to fit pieces together with no luck. Other times, the puzzle comes together easily for me, and I'm putting forth just the right amount of effort, finding that sweet spot where it's not too difficult or too easy. That's the spot to be in for building mastery. If I truly want to practice this skill, I am best served by taking a step back when I feel frustrated about a puzzle. That's not the experience I want to have. In these moments, I could find an easier puzzle to work on instead, so I regain my sense of mastery, or lower my own standards in my head for how well I think I should be doing on it. Puzzles are my thing, but think about what your thing is and how you can create an experience of building mastery with it for yourself. Cope ahead. I love cope ahead, and I also don't do it how DBT recommends. I process best by putting words to my experience and talking through a plan rather than picturing a plan. I didn't realize for years that I was using cope ahead most of the time when driving to work or driving to a social get-together as a way to manage feelings of anxiety that were coming up for me. I would talk to myself while driving and find myself saying things like, if they say blank to me, then I'm just going to say blank back. Or, first I'll get this form out of the way, then I'll respond to my emails, and then I'll start returning phone calls as a way to map out what tasks I'd want to complete at work. Creating a plan like this helps me immensely, even when unexpected things come up I didn't prepare for. Coping ahead by talking out loud to myself, in the car, in the shower, etc., has provided me with a compass over the years to know what direction I want to go in. Other people and outside factors may certainly lead me to needing to adapt and be flexible, but I have a home base to come back to with what I planned for originally. Thinking about it in my head, with or without imagery, or writing it down does not concretize my intentions as much as hearing myself say them out loud. Coping ahead helps me keep the focus on myself and my goals instead of getting caught up in what other people want. I have learned I can show up in a way that feels good to me, no matter what other people may decide to do, and that is all thanks to this skill. If you're not a visualizer either, that's okay. There are many ways to cope ahead.
Awesome.
Okay.
You know what to do at the end of the reading bits.
I know, right? How do we transition? Well, I guess I'll transition in this way because the next thing I'm going to mention, I realized when I recorded, again, the 10-minute blurb. Yeah,
blurb.
Yeah, that I did for last month. I mentioned that we would have a surprise today to announce.
Yeah.
So the surprise is that there is going to be an audiobook version of the book.
Yeah.
For a while, people were asking us, and we were like, we don't know. We knew that the book was obviously going to be available in print format and digital format, i.e. on Kindle, if you like to read that way, but we were not sure about an audiobook. And then the publishing company contacted us, and at first we thought, at least I did, I was like, maybe they're going to want us to record the audiobook. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. And then I thought to myself, well, that's cool, but that's going to be a lot of time and effort. And it turns out they actually were definitely planning to hire somebody who is a professional, I don't know the term, audiobook.
Audio actor or like.
Yeah, voice actor. Yeah. Somebody who does this for a living. I mean, Kate and I podcast, and that's cool. But I realized as we're reading our sections aloud, like, this is harder than you'd think. It is not easy to make an audiobook. So they have selected someone. Kate and I did get to play a role in choosing who it was going to be. But the audiobook will be read aloud by somebody. I believe it's already available on Amazon if you want to choose that format as your way to consume the book. But it's also going to be somebody who's British, because our publishing company is based in the UK. So not only are we hearing somebody else read our words, but we're hearing somebody else read our words with an accent. So that's cool. And if you're a UK listener, it might feel very familiar to you to hear a person reading aloud in a British accent. So the audiobook is, it's happening. It's a thing.
Yeah.
Which is very exciting. So the book can be
very exciting.
Read in multiple ways, and it can be listened to. And then I guess before Kate reads the raffle drawing winners aloud, the other thing that I'll just make sure to mention, because I realized we didn't put this anywhere in the notes, but probably feels important to name. If you are wanting to get your hands on the book and you haven't already, how you can do that.
Through the publishing company, they can get it directly. Also, yes. They don't have to go through Amazon if people don't want to. I know folks.
That is very true. Yes, some people don't. Yeah. So our publishing company is called Jessica Kingsley Publishing. I feel like I should try to find the website here real quick while I'm talking. So yeah, you can definitely order it off of their website. So for us, since we're in the US, it says us.jkp.com. And when you are on their website, you can just search for the book. So you can search for DBT for Everyone and it will pull up and you can order it there. But you can also search for DBT for Everyone on Amazon. And then that's where you can find it in all its formats. And we have a link in the show notes for the
Barnes & Noble too.
Barnes & Noble too. Awesome. Yeah. Perfect. So pretty much almost anywhere that you get your books, you should be able to search for DBT for Everyone and get your hands on it. So, very exciting. An audiobook. Yay!
I know. I for one, am excited to hear it in a British accent just because, I don't know, no offense to either one of us or the book, but, you know, we did a lot of writing and reading and reading and writing and rewriting and rereading of it, and I thought I was probably going to be a little tired of the words contained within this book for a while.
Right.
Like, you know, eat too many of a food for a while and you need to take a rest. But I think it's going to be very exciting and exotic in its own way.
Yeah, it's a different
to hear experience. My words in a different accent. Yeah, we have totally different exposure to it. So I'm for one, I'm excited about.
Yeah, and we got a little taste because there were two different voice actors that we could choose between, and they each read two different portions of the book in their clips. The person we wound up choosing, she read a portion from the Wise Mind chapter, and yeah, I was sitting there listening to her read it, and I was like, wow. Sounds so good. It sounds so smart. Like, oh, these are words I wrote. Bizarre. But like, just sounded really good when someone else was reading it aloud besides us. Because, yeah, we're all tied into this. But it's somebody totally third party, again, who does this for a living and is very good. So, yeah, get your hands on the audiobook if you want to.
Yay, I'm excited. All right, so drum roll. So we have two raffle winners. One from Patreon is Candace. Thank you, Candace. You'll be getting a signed copy of the book. And our coffee hour winner is Amanda. We will be sending out emails to get your mailing addresses. I was going to say tomorrow, but the funny thing is you'll have gotten the emails by the time.
You know,
Or Michelle is going to put it on a to-do list to do it after the 29th, in which case, bless her heart, because I will forget by then.
You know what I realized I did earlier? Because I did the actual drawing about an hour before we recorded. And so I typed up the emails, and I have them scheduled to send out to them actually on the day of the 29th. Oh, so when this
gracious me,
posts,
of course you actually have it right.
I have it ready.
This is why we work well together.
Yes. It's
because she thought of it before saying it out loud.
Candace and Amanda, your emails will be in your inbox. Go check. Go check.
There you go. Forget the proposed time travel that I was just blathering on about. You'll get it at the appropriate time and place. Lord have mercy. Anyway, very excited to send those out to you guys. And I think today we're doing we were trying to think of how to do a closing moment. What would it mean when we're just reading stuff from the book? And so we thought, well, the book has an ending.
Yes.
Which is sort of like its own sort of closing moment. So not the entirety, but I'm going to read you guys a decent portion of the in conclusion chapter for the book. I hope you guys read it and tell us what you think. And please be honest.
Yes. We like honesty. Right?
We like honesty. We want to know. I don't know. I don't do the usual things. Get close your eyes. Right? Sorry, it feels weird. I've never read a closing moment, so pardon me while I adjust to a new way of being. All right. Okay. Go ahead and get comfortable, everybody, whatever that means for you today. Sitting, standing, laying down. Whatever feels good and right in your body. And if you are safe and feel comfortable doing so, I invite you to go ahead and close your eyes. As per usual, we're going to start by just noticing our breath. You don't need to breathe any more slowly or any more deeply than you are naturally. It's just about tuning in. Just about really paying attention to the rhythms and the sensations of your breath and letting them welcome you into your body and into the present moment. And as best you can, try and stay with your breath as I read it to you. Your mind may wander, might get lost in the words and lose the sensation of your body, and that's okay. Just when you notice, do your best to come back into your body, into your breath, and into the moment. The best way to make the most of DBT skills can be summarized in two words. Go slowly. Give yourself time to practice these skills. Anything new that you try, it's going to take time and repetition before it becomes comfortable, let alone instinctual. And the more distressed you feel, the harder new skills become to remember. This is why patience and practice are key. Whether you come to this book as a refresher or if this is your first pass at these skills, it still makes sense to take your time. Focus on one skill or maybe two for a week, 2 weeks, or even longer. Find new and different ways to interact with the skill. You could journal. Teach the skill to a friend or a child, or make art inspired by the skill. Just stick with it and keep rehearsing it until it becomes something akin to second nature, to reach out for the skill when it would be appropriate. It's then that you move on to the next skill on which you want to focus. When we first began writing, we already knew what we hoped our readers would take away at the end of the book. First and foremost, we wish for you to take away something that is useful to you. Whether that be at least one skill you're excited to try, or a skill you've tried while reading and are excited to continue to practice. We also fervently hope
that you come away knowing that DBT is for everyone. No matter your mental health diagnosis or lack thereof, there's something here for everyone. Everyone struggles. No one has all the answers for how to handle struggling with grace. That in turn leads into our final ambition, which is that you finish this book and walk away feeling validated. We want each and every one of you reading this book to see yourself reflected somewhere in these pages, and we want you to know that your struggles and hardships are valid. Everyone needs support, and everyone needs skills. Thanks so much, everyone.
Thanks, everybody. To learn more about us and the DBT skills we're teaching each week, join our Facebook group. Simply log in to your Facebook profile and search for DBT and Me podcast.